Blog Talk Radio.
Incidentally, I know how you feel about all this Christmas business, getting depressed and all that. It happens to me every year. I never get what I really want. I always get a lot of stupid toys or a bicycle or clothes or something like that.
What is it you want?
Real estate.
Of course, if the Amazon drone dropped your new house on top of your old house, flat, then you got real disappointment. Welcome aboard the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? I know we're in that mad dash known as the holiday season, and to make matters worse, a lot of folks are contending with an ice storm, so please take heed and take it easy on those treacherous roads. If you're affected, it might be best to just stay home. Put off the shopping, or let your fingers do the walking in cyberspace. Hopefully we'll be an oasis for you of entertainment and enlightenment. If you're listening to us live Friday, December 6th, that's 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east, we'd love you to join us at 347-857-4505, or you can tweet us as well at AB Writes. I want to note the passing of Nelson Mandela. Yes, he died yesterday at the age of 95. What a model of courage, moral fortitude, and forgiveness. A world leader who meant so much to so many, not only in South Africa, but around the globe. He will be missed, indeed, left behind so much of a great legacy and great spirit. If we can all embody just a modicum of that, the world will be a much better place. Speaking of great spirits, we'll pay homage to the late, great John Lennon as we inch closer to the anniversary of his tragic death in words and song, of course. The Free Flow Pop Culture Combo is coming up. We'll dip into the mailbag. I have some success stories from our Inspiration to Action Challenge to share with you. We've been doing it since September, and some folks have actually done their work, have reached their goals. I'm so impressed and so gratified. We'll talk about that a bit later. But first, I'd like you to meet a guest who has a real important story to tell, and you know we're all about story on this show. Tom North is the author of the new riveting memoir, True North, The Shocking Story behind that film, Yours, Mine, and Ours. Remember the iconic film back in the 60s with Lucille Ball and Henry Fonda about that blended family? It was ostensibly based on a real story, kind of a precursor to the Brady Bunch, I think. They showed the film a lot on cable, if you haven't seen it. It's a fun movie, but apparently not so much based in reality, so says Tom. The Beardsley North household was really one replete with abuse, shame, and fear, not the happily ever after of that comic family that was depicted on the screen. Tom, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your being here, and I want to congratulate you on the book and commend you for having the courage to tell your true story. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show, Amy Beth.
It's a pleasure for you to be here. Let me just go, before we get into the heart of the story, tell us how this became a movie in the first place. It was a human interest story, and I think you mentioned in the book or somewhere in an interview that Lucille Ball had seen the story and decided to buy the rights. Is that right?
Yes, yes. For the benefit of your listeners who haven't the faintest idea what we're talking about,
okay.
The story really starts back in the in 1961 when my mother, Helen North, who had 8 children by the time she was 30 years of age.
God bless her.
I know, God bless her. But my dad, Richard North, was a Navy aviator who was killed flying experimental aircraft. And he left my mom with 8 kids. And so she had family in the San Francisco Bay Area and moved her family down to California from Washington State, where the Navy base we were on was. And so while we were here, very shortly after moving to San Leandro, California, my mother met a man named Frank Beardsley, who had 10 children. And so within 15 months of my father's death, she had married Frank Beardsley and created a family with 18 children. So we know that, you know, 10 and 8 equals ridiculous, but that's what happened.
Wow, yeah.
And
now,
then shortly thereafter, within the first 3 years, they had 2 more children.
Wow, so, okay, so they had kids together too. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So Lucille Ball did see this story in the newspapers because it was a human interest story at the time, you know, the merger of 2 large families. And so she called my mother and stepfather suggesting that a movie be made about the merger of these 2 big families.
Wow. So, and the rest, obviously, they came to an agreement and they did it. And it must be surreal to see your life depicted on screen, good, bad, or indifferent, because whatever happens, even if it's pretty accurate, it's never completely the way it is, because producers and writers always take liberties to enhance the dramatic effects, et cetera.
Sure,
case,
now, the interesting thing is in, yeah. And this is where the story starts to warm up, is that when Lucy came to Carmel to meet the family and to learn something about the character that she would play in the film, she took my mother aside and she said to her, "You keep that man away from me." She had met my mother and my stepdad, and she immediately picked up on his energy. And he was an ultra-violent, alcoholic, misogynistic pedophile. That's the way one of my sisters has described him. So he was a very dangerous man, and the reason my mother married him was to save his children from him. And she shared that with me later in life, is that she was afraid he was going to kill his children. Now, he was a widower when she met him. He was a widower with 10 children, and he was completely unqualified for that job. But there he was, and she was afraid that he was going to severely hurt or kill his children. And those were her words. She said, "I was afraid he was going to kill them." And so
she thought she could save the kids, and she didn't realize how bad it would be for her kids.
Well, there you go. There you go. Really didn't look at it from that perspective. She just saw 10 children in need and said, "I can step in and help them." But she didn't realize that she was taking her own 8 children into a very dangerous environment and abandoning them there.
Wow.
So,
now, some of your siblings, you and some of your siblings, had come to call the story of this movie, which became very popular, as the big lie, because your parents, even your mom, I think, for a long time wanted to perpetuate the myth that your family really was happy, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Now, she was very, very focused on promoting an image of similarity to the movie. She wanted everyone to believe that her family was just like Lucille Ball and Henry Fonda and the movie Yours, Mine, and Ours. So that was actually the perception in the minds of the community and in the public at large. And of course,
so you were living sort of what we'd say, like in counseling, they always talk about looking good families. On the outside, everything looks good, but then when you get behind closed doors, there's all this dysfunction and pain and shame and all of that. And you were living that to a really high level, it seems.
That's correct. Yeah.
Go ahead, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, what do you want to share with us in terms of what your daily life was like, and how did you find out that your stepfather really was as monstrous as it turned out he was?
Yeah.
Did you know that from the beginning, or was it did it evolve over time?
Yeah, that became apparent very early on. He was, you know, when we met him and my mother introduced him as our new dad, the response from the North children was, "Well, we don't want a new dad." And my mother said, "Well, I don't remember ever asking you whether you wanted a new dad or not. You're getting one." And so, he told us that we would address him as sir or dad. And when I said, you know, "But you're not my dad," he, you know, looked at me and he said, "Well, I am your new dad." And, he threatened to give me the back of his hand. So I knew right away that we were in trouble with this guy. And
now, were they married when he did she introduce you to him before?
No, this was
before they were married. Before they were married.
And then when they did get married, in a sense, the gloves came off and he actually got worse. So
old were you, Tom, at the time? Were you when they got married?
I was 7 years old when they married. And 6 when my dad was killed, so it was a very, very confusing time. And when my mother married Frank Beardsley, very shortly thereafter, he took some of us kids to a football game in San Francisco. And on the way back, we were all supposed to be sleeping in the station wagon. I was awake listening to them, and they were arguing in the front seat about the fact that he wanted to visit an old girlfriend of his on the way home. And my mother told him that was inappropriate because he was married now and he needed to leave old girlfriends behind. And so he went into a tantrum and was raging at her and telling her to shut up and do what he told her to do. And I had never heard anyone talk like that before. And so at the age of 7, I knew we were in really deep trouble. It was nothing to come around. It was common, I should say, to come around the corner, and he would be walking down the hall, and he would just knock me across the room. And I would get up and say, "What was that for?" And he would say, "Just for drill." So
oh,
that's
gosh.
When,
oh,
yeah,
he horrible.
Was, yeah, horrible, horrible human being.
Now, did you have? Now, where were you in the birth order? Did you have older siblings that were kind of your protectors, or became your protectors?
Well, so I was the fourth of my mother's 8 children, and then I was the 11th of the 20 Beardsley children. And all of us, both North and Beardsley children, we kind of watched out for each other, let each other know if he was in the vicinity or when he would come home from work. He was a Navy officer as well. And he was the personnel officer at the Navy Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And when he would come home from work, the kids would pass the word among each other, "He's home. Run."
Yeah.
And so we would just, yeah, there would be kids, you know, running outdoors and making themselves scarce.
Now, what was your relationship with the Beardsley kids? I mean, did you get along with them right away, or was this bonding over the fact that this man was so horrible to everybody?
Yeah, you know, he was an equal opportunity abuser, so we just kind of, as much as we could, we watched each other's backs.
Now, what was your mother, now I know years later she told you she married him to save his kids, but during this time, did people appeal to your mom? Did she know what was going on? Did she turn a blind eye? What was the dynamic with that?
Yeah, and so that's really kind of a common sense question. It begs the question, what was she thinking? And
yes.
Many of her relatives, she came from a large family herself. There were 10 children in her family. And many of her brothers and sisters told her, "Don't do this. This is not a good idea." And she told them to buzz off. She said, "You know, I've got to save these kids. So whatever happens is going to happen, and I'm going to do this, and don't tell me not to." So, and eventually, because Frank Beardsley knew that he was, that everybody had his number, that, you know, he wasn't pulling any wool over anyone's eyes, he banned her family from the house eventually.
So, yeah, that's a typical abuser thing to do, obviously,
yeah.
To isolate. But what was your mom's dynamic within the house? I mean, how did she respond to him? Was she trying to diffuse his anger? Did she just ignore it? I mean, how did that work out in the day-to-day of the house with, obviously, there was sheer terror on the part of the kids?
Well, you know, she was, to some degree, a stabilizing influence in the house. And while the North children, and this is kind of an interesting contrast, while the North children had known a very loving, stable household prior to Richard North's death. And it was a household where there was lots of laughter and hugging and playing with the children, and it was a wonderful place to be a child. But when we became part of the Beardsley family, you know, we took this huge step into an environment that we had no control over, and it was just a mess. But for the Beardsley children, the presence of Helen North Beardsley was a breath of fresh air, and she was a stabilizing influence for them. And, you know, they are grateful to this day for her presence in their lives.
So she did actually save them, yeah, in a way.
Well, to some degree, she was an improvement. She was an improvement on what they had known before.
So I'm sensing that among the Beardsley clan, they're probably not as angry with your mother as you and your North siblings probably are. I mean, am I sensing you have some anger towards your mom for getting you involved with this guy to begin with?
Well, that's a really interesting point that you raise there, Amy Beth, because during 1989, I actually took the whole family through family therapy, and those issues came up, those issues of anger at my mother for bringing us in there, and they did come from the North children. And that's when it was shared by the Beardsley kids, you know, that hey, you know, she was an improvement in our lives, and so there is this enormous contrast in perspective between the two sides of the family.
Now, did you reconcile it with your mom? Have you done that?
Well, yes. You know, it was personally, I had a very contentious relationship with her my entire life. I was the uncontrollable child and always gone without permission and not following the rules. I was sort of the difficult one, and she didn't appreciate that. So we were at odds my entire life, and that never changed. But I was totally devoted to her while, you know, she was in my life and did everything I could to help a very difficult situation.
It's a fascinating, complicated story. I mean, it has to be with all those different personalities and all those kids, a variety of ages. That's enough if things were going well. I mean, if you had two solid, stable parents, that would be difficult. I mean, it would be like the Brady Bunch on steroids. But here you have a situation where you had some severe dysfunction and abuse that was just must have been horrifying. It also was at a time when, A, you had the movie, so you had that thing to live up to, that story. But also people weren't talking about these issues back then as much as we do now. I mean, it's still a lot of shame sometimes shrouded in it, which is why it's brave of you to share your story. And I know that's important to you to help other people who feel like they're alone in their abusive situations. But it must have been harrowing, really, in those days to confronted, and you probably felt like, what the heck is this all about, especially coming from a situation where when you up till you were six, you had a very happy, loving family, and then all of a sudden, traumatically, your dad is dead, and now you have this other guy by the time you're seven who you're forced to consider your new father. I mean, wow.
Yeah, you know, it was crazy-making for us to try and reconcile that, and there really was no reconciling this situation. There was one event where Frank Beardsley went after one of my older sisters, and this was when I was about 12 years old, and he was chasing her through the house, and she ran outside, so I stepped into the doorway to prevent him from chasing her, and that gave her enough time to get away. And so following that, my sister and I and one of our other older sisters went up to the local Catholic church to get help. And we said, you know, this man is just crazy. We've got to get help. And so we went to the church and knocked on the rectory door, and the priest came, and I explained to him what was going on in the house at length and said, you know, you've got to help us. And he looked down at me, and he smiled, and he said, Tommy, he said, what I want you to do is go home and apologize to your dad.
Oh,
and of course,
God.
And my response was, he's not my dad. And he said, oh, of course he's your dad. Now you go home and apologize, and I want to see you in church on Saturday, young man, to confess this sin of calumny. And calumny is the sin of saying something bad about a person who's in a position of authority. So we knew when we left the church there that there was no one who was going to help us. Had we gone to the police, they would have called the parents. Frank would have denied everything, and then he would have beaten us severely. So we were in serious trouble, and there just wasn't any help. And the conflict that we felt having to support this fantasy of yours, mine, and ours while living in a war zone was just very, very destructive. And in fact, I got into substance abuse as a teenager. Of course, this was the late 60s and early 70s, so a lot of teenagers did that. But it was a long time before I went into recovery.
What a horrible way to live, and the fact that you really had nobody to turn to except each other. I mean, the good thing, I guess, you had all these siblings. So were there a lot of conflicts among you or because you, amongst all the kids, or were you bonded so strongly as a unit to combat what was a pretty scary enemy, I guess, in the house?
Well, you know the there is an old saying that trouble rolls downhill. And so there was definitely a pecking order among the children. And so, you know, the older kids would sometimes pick on the younger kids, and so there was strife everywhere.
And, of course, abuse sometimes cycles through, too, where people,
sure.
You know, the abuse sometimes become the abuser, so there's always that worry that, I don't know if any of your siblings took on any of the abusive traits or had to work through that, but that's, wow, what a story. And now you're sharing it. What took you so long, I guess people would say, it took you decades to really put this down on paper. Was it dealing with the family, dealing with your mother, or just you figured, now I really have to tell it?
Well, you know, during the family therapy sessions, which were incredibly productive, it was a wonderful experience for a lot of us. And afterwards, there were some of us who agreed never to support the lie of yours, mine, and ours ever again. Not that there was anything wrong with the film. It was a very heartwarming, funny, entertaining film, and Lucille Ball did a great job with it. It just didn't reflect our experience. So we agreed not to support that any longer, and in subsequent social conversation, when people would ask me how the film reflected real life, if it was appropriate, I would share with them the real story. And they would say, oh, that's a book. You have to write a book.
And I
just dismiss that right away. But over time, because, of course, the therapy sessions were in 1989, and over time, quite a few people came back to me and said, you know, based on what you shared with me about your family therapy sessions, I figured if you could do that with 20 people, I could certainly attempt that with the 4 or 5 people in my family. And I went back and I got resolution on issues of my own. So thank you for having shared that story. And so I thought, well, maybe there is a place for a book. And so I wrote the book.
Sure, there definitely is a place for it. I'm sure you know as you go around reading and sharing the story with people in groups and signings, et cetera. I'm sure you have found a lot of people coming up to you and saying, yeah, that's my story too, or similar. It's not their story because everybody's story is individual, and your story is so unique, not only because of the movie, but because of the large amount of kids that are involved. But I'm sure there's a lot of things that resonate with many people because, unfortunately, a lot of people are subject to abusive families.
And that's probably the most important point you could raise, Amy Beth, because it is very common for people to come up to me and say, you know, based on what I read in your book, I went, and it was the same story again. People said, you know, it gave me permission,
permission
to look within myself and deal with my own issues. Because really, what people are concerned about is themselves and their own life experience and their own circumstances. And so when they read this story, The True North, The Shocking Truth About Yours, Mine, and Ours, they reflect upon their own lives. And it gives them permission to deal with some of their own issues. And that's what people have been sharing with me.
And just feel the pain and don't feel that, you know, let the pain come out and don't be shamed by it, you know, that it's not their fault.
And it won't hurt you on the way out, you know.
Right.
You
well,
get
it may hurt a little bit, but it's better
to hold on to it.
In fact,
what happens when we deal with that is we actually re-experience that pain. But once it's gone, once we've done that and let it go, it's gone.
Yeah,
I just finished I just finished 47 weeks of a program called Breakthrough for Men. It's a very small organization. It's just here in Carmel, California, and started by a man named Fred Jellis, who said, you know what, the programming that men in our society get is a no-win situation, and we've got to change that. And so we created an environment where men could come and work on their issues, their life issues. And so I went through that program and discharged a lot of the emotional content of the memories that I had from a very dysfunctional childhood. And that's what we have to do if we're going to integrate ourselves, is to discharge the emotional content of those memories.
That's when the healing really, the true healing really begins. What was your reaction in the family? Were there other of the children who were against you writing the book, or did everybody support it, and do they agree with the way you told it?
Yeah, great question. I am not really popular in the family right now.
Oh, really?
None of the Beardsleys are supportive, and five of the North children are supportive. Two of them are not, and even among those five who are supportive, it's a really difficult issue for them to address. And it's just, again, it's the fact that there is so much emotional content to those memories for them, and they don't want to look at it.
They don't want to. But they went through family therapy with you.
That was just the beginning.
Right, and they don't want to take it further.
The interesting thing about family therapy or personal therapy, and I'm sure your listeners who have been through therapy will understand this, is that when you clear out the closets of all the ghosts and the skeletons that have resided there, all of the issues, you have to fill that space with a positive set of experiences and create a new memory to fill that space. And if you don't do that, then those ghosts will come back.
It's ongoing.
So
you're further along in your recovery of this healing of what you experienced than many of your siblings, so they're resisting living through it again. They just don't want to deal with it, and that's okay.
I think that's an accurate observation. But I'm just, you know, I've been at this since I was 17, and I write about that in the book, how I was introduced to the whole recovery process. And it started when I was 17, and I got so much out of that initial therapeutic experience that I said, okay, I know that there's been a lot of damage done in my life, and I know it's going to be a long process, but this, I want to be a happy person, and I know I'm going to have to deal with these issues if I'm going to get there. And so anyone who's been through recovery will tell you that it's one day at a time, and it's ongoing, and it never ends. And
the process,
just make peace with that.
And you're sharing the process, and you're sharing your story with so many people, and I'm sure you're empowering them, as you said, and giving them hope to tackle these issues at their own rate, at their own pace, in the way they can do it. I thank you for joining us, Tom. People want to find out more about the book, they can go to your website. It's TrueNorthByTomNorth.com. Is that right?
That's correct.
Also, you're on Twitter. You're also on Twitter, I know. It's TrueNorthBook, or at TrueNorthBook. I wish you the best. Thank you for telling the story. I know it takes a lot of courage. And I wish you the best. I hope you come back and see us again.
Thank you for having me on your show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Bye.
That's Tom North on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Find out more about him at Twitter at True North Book. And stick around. We're coming back. We have our John Lennon tribute. We'll also check out the Inspiration to Action Challenge coming up on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show.
The foaming cleanser, clean pots and pans just like a whiz.
Ajax cuts grease faster than any other leading cleanser.
Use the paying the elbow tax when you start cleaning with Ajax.
Ajax really polishes as it cleans.
So use Ajax, the foaming cleanser.
floats the dirt right down the drain.
By gosh, they're right. Foaming action Ajax makes even the dirtiest pan shine like new in a jiffy.
So use Ajax!
Snap! What a happy sound! Snap is the happiest sound I've found. You may clap, rap, tap, slap, but snap makes the world go round. Snap, crackle, Rice Krispies. I say it's crackle, the crispy sound. You gotta have crackle or the clock's not wound. Geese cackle, feathers tickle, belts buckle, beef pickle, but crackle makes the world go round. Snap, crackle, Rice Krispies. I insist that pop's the sound. The best is missed unless pop's around. You can't stop hopping when the cereal's popping. Pop makes the world go round. Snap, crackle, pop, Rice Krispies. Snap, crackle, pop, Rice Krispies. Kellogg's best to you.
Our life together is so precious. Together we have grown. We have grown. Although our love is still special, let's take a chance and fly away somewhere.
It's been too long since we took the time. No one's to blame. I know time flies so quickly.
Love. Seeing it's Thanksgiving, we thought we'd make tonight a little bit of a joyous occasion by inviting someone up with us onto stage. And I'm sure he will be no stranger to anybody in the audience when I say it's our great privilege and your great privilege to see and hear Mr. John Lennon.
Have those gremlins again in the studio, don't we? I think we're having little audio issues. Hey, welcome back. It is the Amy Betharquis Show. Not your fault, Trudy. These things happen. We are remembering John Lennon. It was 33 years ago, almost to the day, when we lost John Lennon. We heard the news, and for those of us who were too young to remember the assassination of JFK, 12-8-80, the night John Lennon was gunned down and murdered in front of his home at the Dakota in New York City, was really our collective loss of innocence. For kids born in the 60s and 70s, the brutal death of a cultural icon was our jolt into what would be an unforgiving decade. A friend broke the news, and we spent time riveted mostly to the radio because it was before 24/7 cable, so we turned to the DJs to offer comfort and context. Already intrigued by Marconi's box, this episode lured me closer to what would be a rewarding, if somewhat tumultuous, career in radio. Coming of age in the era of Ronald Reagan, AIDS, and Gordon Gekko's Greed is Good rally cry, our generation may have been more cynical, in fact we were, than the boomers before us, but we still have that music to sow generation to generation, and for over 50 years the Beatles have been a common thread in that cultural mosaic. They meant so much to us. You know, John was dubbed the Smart Beatle. His musical and literary sophistication is apparent in a wide spectrum of the group's tunes, including Norwegian Wood, Strawberry Fields, the classic ballad of John and Yoko. His solo career was pretty substantial, too, especially considering his self-described house husband hiatus in the mid-70s, and, of course, his tragic death at 40. He had poetic flourishes, of course, the iconic Imagine and Watching the Wheels, and he paid homage to his early rock roots in songs like Starting Over and Whatever Gets You Through the Night. He had a bold personal persona and a wry sense of humor that made him something of an acquired taste at first. His infamous 1965 comment about the Beatles being bigger than Jesus was misconstrued, and it did lead to a brief U.S. radio ban. But the thing was, John Lennon never said the Beatles were greater than Jesus. He was making a sarcastic observation about the outrageous hoopla that fueled Beatlemania. And, you know, let's face it, sound bites are not kind to nuance and the shades of gray. But there will be other stars that would face us over the years. Sinead O'Connor, Cat Stevens, who's now known as Yusuf Islam, and the Dixie Chicks would all share such backlashes with varying rebounds. The Beatles, of course, persisted.
Standing in the darkest of hands, trying to get to Holland.
Yoko Ono and the Ballad of John and Yoko, as we remember John Lennon on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. You know, Yoko gets a bad rap, too, because everyone still blames her for breaking up the Beatles. But if you read the fine print, it seems that it was really Paul McCartney and John Lennon and their diverging ideas about life and art that was at the root of the breakup. Now, yeah, I'm not saying Yoko didn't contribute to John's sensibilities, but you can't blame it on Yoko. She gets a bad rap, I think. But during the 70s, you know, Lennon and the Beatles, their popularity continued. Some were offended, others amused and enlightened by John and Yoko's famous Bed In for Peace. It was part early 70s publicity stunt, part traveling demonstration. The events were really staged to end the war in Vietnam. But they irritated the so-called establishment so much that they earned John Lennon a spot on Richard Nixon's infamous enemies list. So Nixon and his FBI henchman, J. Edgar Hoover, were so threatened by John's charisma and his sway with the already divisive youth culture, they actually waged a campaign to oust him from the country. They used a minor pot bust years earlier in the U.K. as their ammo. Now, if you have seen this documentary called The U.S. versus John Lennon, it really captures that case and really the era in vivid detail. It's now available, I think, on DVD or download. The plot for Lennon's deportation obviously was squashed by the public outrage with a little help from John's friends in the arts and politics, and he was indeed allowed to stay in the adopted city with which he shared such mutual love. There's a great PBS documentary called Lennon NYC, which I think last year or the year before was part of the American Master series. That's also probably on DVD at this point. And that offers an intimate exploration of John Lennon's life in New York and really his state of contentment and rebirth at the time of his death, which just adds to the potency of that tragedy. You know, given his sense of irony, and had he known his fate on that quiet, peaceful New York City street he called home, John Lennon would probably have just shrugged and hummed a few lines from his classic Instant Karma. He was that kind of a guy. And now we have another glitch now, okay. This is what happens when you do live radio without a net. All right, the system is not working. It happens. We can't take a break because the system is not working for us. We'll see if we can work out the glitches. Trudy, try to work on that for us as we remember John Lennon, who really left such an impact on so many people's lives. To this day, it's his music, it's his spirit. A lot of people have a debt of gratitude towards him, musicians with a conscience, people from Bono to Springsteen, John Mellencamp to the Indigo Girls, the Dixie Chicks, really owe a lot to John Lennon's audacity and his sense of commitment to society and to the world around him. He really shared that. And Yoko, who gets, as I said, does get a bad rap because they blame her for breaking up the Beatles. She also has some limited abilities, perhaps certainly in the singing department, and they question her artistic endeavors. But she has the true essence of an artist. She's out there and trying so hard to offer herself and her consciousness and doing good works in the world. Hang on, we're going to see if we can get ourselves restarted here.
Together, pretty soon you're gonna be dead. Few before him, and even fewer after, would so eloquently voice the social concerns of his generation. Through his lyrics and peace-loving activism, John Lennon became more than a mere entertainer. He became an icon, a cult figure whose fans hung on his every word. The music of Lennon and his famed Beatles would form the soundtrack to a cultural revolution throughout the 60s. After the band's breakup in 1970, Lennon remained in the public eye as a successful solo act and vocal social activist before finally retreating to his quiet life as a house husband in 1975. But in 1980, he would reemerge with a new album and a new passion for recording. He was returning from the studio when the unthinkable happened.
John Lennon was brought to the emergency room shortly before 11 p.m. He was dead on arrival.
Dr. Stephen Lynn of New York City's Roosevelt Hospital making the announcement that musician, composer, and former Beatle John Lennon is dead. Lennon was shot to death outside his New York apartment around 11 o'clock Eastern Time.
There were numerous wounds that entered the heart and the large vessels within the chest, causing a massive blood loss that could not be repaired or restored.
Dr. Lynn says Lennon suffered at least 7 gunshot wounds. Lennon was ambushed as he and his wife Yoko Ono were returning home from a recording session, allegedly by Hawaii native David Chapman.
And Mr. Chapman came up behind him and called to him, Mr. Lennon, as he arrived at that doorway. And then in a combat stance, he emptied the Charter Arms 38 caliber gun that he had with him and shot John Lennon.
As news of John Lennon's murder broke, airwaves around the world were filled with his music. Millions of Americans were seated comfortably in front of their televisions watching the New England Patriots battle the Miami Dolphins on ABC Television's Monday Night Football when commentator Howard Cosell interrupted the play-by-play with the tragic news.
In case the folks missed the earlier news flash, ABC News has confirmed that John Lennon, a member of the famed Beatles, may be the best-known member, was shot twice in the back outside of his apartment building in the west side of New York tonight, rushed to the Roosevelt Hospital, dead on arrival. An unspeakable tragedy. Details on Nightline 30 minutes after the end of this concert.
Lennon was fatally shot by a disturbed fan named Mark David Chapman, who just hours before had received Lennon's autograph on an album cover. The assassination had the style and twisted motive of a political assassination. And to his millions of fans, the impact felt the same. But this time, the target was not a powerful policymaker, but a simple musician with a yearning for peace.
I was reading a magazine and thinking of a rock and roll song. The year was 1954, and I hadn't been playing that long when a man came on the radio, and this is what he said. He said, "I hate to break it to his fans, but Johnny Ace is dead." Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I really wasn't such a Johnny Ace fan, but I felt bad all the same. So I sent away for his photograph, and I waited till it came. It came all the way from Texas with a sad and simple face, and they signed it on the bottom, "From the late great Johnny Ace." Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Simon and the beautiful song, The Late Great Johnny Ace, as we remember John Lennon on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, and Bill Curtis with some cultural context from the We Interrupt This Broadcast series. Thank you for sticking with us for our technical glitches. It's live radio without a net. We're doing what we can. Trudy's tearing her hair out, but we're back in business. Don't worry, Trudy. You know, John Lennon was a complicated man. There's no question about it. He was a poet with a showman's touch, an idealist with a pragmatic knack. I think about it. He paired the Lennon Ono classic War Is Over with Happy Christmas. It was such a brilliant move because that medley has become a multi-generational anthem that is played annually on thousands of radio stations worldwide. In fact, I'm sure you've heard it already this season a few dozen times. He had suffered early tragedy. He lost his mom. She died in a car crash when he was 17. And as a father, he admittedly had a tricky relationship with his oldest son, Julian. Julian has said that the two were repairing their strains at the time of John's death. He was famous for his devotion to Yoko, but he left her briefly for another woman and had just returned really in time to rekindle both their passionate romance and his career. The comeback album, Double Fantasy, was released just 3 weeks before his death. Amazing.
People say I'm crazy, doing what I'm doing. Well, they give me all kinds of warnings to save me from ruin. When I say that I'm okay, well, they look at me kind of strange. Designed to enlighten me. When I tell them that I'm doing fine, watching shadows on the wall. Don't you miss the big time, boy, you're no longer on the ball.
my hand. Life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans.
Tragically ironic song, Beautiful Boy. Life indeed is what happens when we're busy making other plans. John Lennon would never get to see his young son, Sean, come of age. He died when Sean was only 5 years old. As we remember John Lennon coming up on the anniversary, the 33rd anniversary, wow, of his tragic death. You know, we think about it, the country is really still kind of embroiled in a lot of conflict here. We're corroded by a growing social and economic inequity. It's hard not to heed Lenin's clarion call for peace and justice. And it really is up to all citizens to arm ourselves with knowledge and speak truth to power. And especially we think about Nelson Mandela just passing away, how close those two men were in terms of their thinking and their ideals. More people were like that. More people armed themselves with that kind of kindness and forgiveness and motivation to change the world for the better. I think we'd be better off, obviously. So let's think about doing that. From his exquisite discography to his indelible influences in music, pop culture, and society, John Lennon will indeed forever shine on and on, like the moon and the stars and the sun. We remember you, John Lennon, legacy of great music and great spirit.
So this is Christmas, and what have you done? Another year over, and you won't just be gone. And so this is Christmas, I hope you have fun. The near and the old and the young.
over. 6-1. John Lennon, Yoko Ono, as we wrap up our tribute to the late great John Lennon on the Amy Grant Buckley Show. Happy Christmas, indeed. Thank you for putting up with our technical glitches. Trudy, it's okay. We got through it. Hey, listen, the holidays are just around the corner. Speaking of great holiday songs, we're putting together our Happy Holidays special for you on Friday, December 20th, 2 weeks from today. And we'd love to get your requests and dedications in like we did for the Grateful Bounty. We need them ahead of time. We need them by next Friday, December 13th. Yes, Friday the 13th. So hop over to the website, amybetharkowee.com, and let us know what you'd like to hear. And if you have any dedications, we'll be glad to mention those as well. Or you can do it via Twitter at ABWrites. If you do that, though, please use the hashtag holidays, H-O-L-I-D-A-Z-E, so it will grab our attention and won't get lost in the stream of other comments and connections. All right, it's going to be fun. We're going to have your favorites, some of my favorites, and we'll sprinkle in some humor and inspiration along the way, too, just to have a little fun. Speaking of inspiration, the Inspiration to Action Challenge has been going on since September, and we are already fielding lots of success stories. That makes me feel so happy when it works for you. It's really the idea to shake up your attitude about life and get down to business in a more productive and creative, inspiring way. And a couple of success stories this week to point out. Lenore in Rhode Island says, get this, she's working on an opera. Yes, she and a collaborator have already outlined the entire opera and have done the first draft of the first act. Wow, I'm impressed. I'm not an opera aficionado, but I'm impressed. Good for you, Lenore. Keep going and keep us posted. And Danny says that he has outlined a book and he's also enrolling in a screenwriting class this spring. So there you go, Danny. I am happy that people are taking this on, and it's helping them, and I hope it's helping you. And if you need any creativity coaching questions, concerns answered, by all means, stop by the website. Also, if you'd like a shout-out for your progress or your completion of your goal, we'd love to be able to do that for you as well. You can reach us, of course, at the website, also via the Blog Talk site where you can follow the show. It's the Amy Beth Arkowee Show. We can also get the show downloaded via iTunes, or you can catch up with us on Twitter at ABWrites. So many sites, so little time. You want to find me, you can find me, and you know, frankly, we want to be found. So get in touch. Also at the website, you can find out more about the Eliza Gordon mystery series, both Killing Time and Dead Silent, available for ebook download. And, of course, paperback. It makes a great stocking stuffer for the mystery lover on your list. It is amazing that we are closing in. Hanukkah's over already because it was so early this year, and we're closing in on Christmas, so get the shopping done, but be careful with the driving because it's a little tricky out there, especially with the places that are affected by the ice storm. Well, we had some glitches today, didn't we? We can't ignore that, but we did. We got through it with some smart thinking on the part of our TCS crew. Thank you, Trudy. Thank you, Aurora. And thank you, ML, at TCS headquarters. Hey, thanks very much again to Tom North. What a courageous story to come out and put it to the fore and let the world know the inside story, the shocking true story behind that movie, Yours, Mine, and Ours. And he's not bitter. You know, he's had a lot of therapy. He's worked through a lot of these issues. He actually likes the movie. I would think it would make you cringe, but he likes the movie, but he says it's just wishes his life really was like that. And, in fact, it clearly was not. Find out more about his book at TrueNorthByTomNorth.com or at Twitter, TrueNorthBook. Find out more, a very courageous, inspiring story of recovery and coming out the other end. Because you can do it. If you want to do it, you can do it, but it does take some work. Thank you so much for joining us and putting up with all the technical glitches. We do appreciate it. It's always fun. Coming up on Monday, oh, yeah, FanFave Patrick Moore is back with us, you know, from the All Things Crime blog. We'll talk about Naughty at a Price, the Christmas season crime docket. And Kevin Jablowski will join us. He is the author of 8-Bit Christmas. It is being billed as a Christmas story for the Nintendo generation. Mm-hmm. So we're taking nostalgia up a couple of decades. And we're still not in the current day. We'll talk about reviving a classic and why he picked the 80s to set it in. That's coming up. We'll sprinkle in maybe a couple of holiday songs along the way, too, as we get closer to our holiday special. And just have some fun, a little oasis away from the pressures and the hustle-bustle of the season, because I know it's supposed to be a jolly time, but for a lot of people, there's lots of stress, right? People get very overstressed, too much to do, too many expectations, and they have parties to go to, and there may be some, you know, shenanigans on the roadways. So we don't need the ice storm, Mama Nature. So please, take it easy, take care, drive safe, play nice, dream big, and come back and see us again on the Amy Beth Arkowee Show, being brought to you today in part by Time Warner Cable Movies on Demand, and also by 5-Hour Energy. You might need that these days. We'll see you on Monday. Have yourself a great weekend. Send you out a couple more. For John Lennon. Here's George Harrison all those years ago on the Amy Beth Arkley Show.
Well, they cheated you like a dove, blame you for the one who had made it so clear all those years ago. Talking all about how to give, they don't act with much honesty.
And I hope to see you again soon, and I love you, and thank you very much. Now, till we meet again.
right there, shall we? Okay, put the red lights off.
This is Johnny Rhythm just saying good night to you all, and God bless you.